I'm here with Dee Dee Risher, a 55-year-old woman, a resident of Germantown, Philadelphia, and has been a longtime activist and radical in our society. Hi, Miss Risher.
Hello.
She's also my mom.
Yes, I am.
What are some economic practices that you think you've taken on that embody your values economically?
Well, until most recently, I started a job a month ago, but until that, I've only been employed as an adult in jobs where you actually set your salary based on what you think you need, as opposed to any set salary that the organization would offer. In general, I think our household tries to work from the bottom, not the top. So we have a certain salary that comes in, but we basically try to build up our consumption from what we really think we need and always looking at needs and wants. In a way, we live far below our income level, so that frees us to do other things. Right now, it's this community co-housing experiment that we're just starting. But in the past, it's also been giving away a lot more money than you would expect at our income level. In raising the two of you, my two children, my desire has been not to make you into consumers. But I'm quite aware that when you raise a child with a sense of deprivation, it can actually backfire, that they may feel, even though rationally they may know, or you may explain to them that it's kind of a value system at work, it's not because of, it's not driven by scarcity. It doesn't really matter from the kids' perspective. They still may feel that scarcity, and they still may then end up being a consumer on steroids, which is what I notice with a lot of people I know who grew up poor and then have more wealth. It's just really important, because they've never had wealth, to really be a consumer, you know. If you grow up in a community of people who are all practicing a fair amount of asceticism, lack of consumerism, then you don't feel odd. But when you grow up in a society where this is the whole mainstream culture is telling you that you are poor, you do feel poor, and you want to rectify that when you can. And I'll just back up to say, I probably the biggest financial impact, or possibly financial impact, is that neither Will or I really like the stock market as a paradigm. And the whole idea of the stock market, and you are a shareholder, and so you make money when this company makes profits, seems incredibly destructive. We've also tried to put a lot of money in community loan funds and stuff. So what were the reasons? So that's a big thing, because I think I would say that my father did not make his wealth off of running a school. He made his wealth off of investment in the stock market.
You just talked about your, as you were raised as a child, what were your family's values around economics, about money, spending?
Well, I grew up middle class. I think some people, I would say upper middle class. My dad, my grandfather, none of my grandparents were wealthy, and my grandfather was really not wealthy. He didn't even finish high school, but he was able to go to college by just self-studying, and got a scholarship, and then he launched a very middle-class career. So when my dad was 26, his career was being principal of a school, so he launched my dad in a sister school because the school was so successful. So we grew up with that. My dad was running his own business, which was a boarding school, which he was put the head of at 26. My mom was the daughter of farmers, and farmers are not the same, in a kind of different class than business owners, I guess. And I felt like I got an interesting blend in my childhood. On the one hand, when I was 6 years old, my dad was paying for and building his own 7-bedroom house. So he was relatively young at that point, 32 years old, and he was paying to build a house on a large plot of land. On the other hand, my mom sewed all our clothes. She made all our food. She was a farmer's daughter. She didn't hire caterers. My parents' business kind of ran because she worked in the mess hall and she planted trees in the yard on the campus. So it was very do-it-yourself from the ground up. And I think I got both of those streams, you know, both the kind of frugal do-it-yourself and the sense of financial security that came from my dad. And I actually think that that's made me reflect on the role of financial security in a kid's esteem. Like, you know, my parents aren't poor. You know, my dad has this business. So it kind of buffered me from any kind of self-imposed criticism. At the same time, I was not a princess. My mom was not about to treat her kids like princesses. We were like farm kids. We just went out. We ran around. We had jobs. I worked from seventh grade on at little this job or that job. And so it was a blended economic situation. And I think it was quite healthy.
Could you describe your parents, maybe their values set for you or expectations set for you?
They wanted us to get a good education. All of us were expected to go to college. And none of us were ever told that this or that degree, history or English, was foolish because it didn't have good career options after it. In fact, my mom majored in English and in Latin, I think, and my dad majored in history. So they were liberal arts kind of focused people. I think my parents assumed we could take care of ourselves. Even though my dad is financially well off, he's made his school nonprofit and all that stuff, but he's very financially secure. He has been extremely clear about the fact that he expects us to take care of ourselves and that he is not expecting to give us his money or support us. He's very concerned about that.
And now you're more radical than a lot of our society. What would you attribute the change to? I know you've mentioned third world
census. Yes, I think I said I was in China for 2 years. I was just a teacher. I was a teacher in a stratified society. It was before Tiananmen Square, so it was in 1985 to 1987 that I was actually in Beijing, the capital city. So it wasn't any deprived countryside. As a foreign teacher, I was paid well. I was paid about 20 times what my adult students who were older than me were paid as chemistry teachers or whatever they taught. You had to buy at certain stores and live in certain places, and everything cost more. But it did strike me that then that teachers who, like me, were making 600 yuan a month, and our students were often making 30 to 50, would sit around these foreign teachers and say how they just felt like they weren't paid enough. And that's when I realized that people are always looking up in their lifestyle. They're never looking at how many people are below them. They're just always comparing themselves up and thinking, I don't have enough, I don't have enough, and the needs are endless. The other, of course, most important tradition is that I'm a Christian. So, know, I'm pondering these Bible stories about abundance, jubilee. You know, it's hard for rich people to enter the kingdom of heaven. There are many, many stories about mainly where your treasure is, so will your heart be. All these meditations on how wealth distracts us from a spiritual world and from a sense of that. And I truly, I even experience that now. You can experience that as a poor person, and you can experience that as a rich person. If you don't have enough, your mind gets very fixated on getting enough. So that was a big tradition also. I think the third thing was that, you know, after college, I spent several years, and before I went to China, in some of the poorer segments of the population. I stayed in rural African-American homes for 4 months. And then I lived also 2 years in inner city D.C., which was my first inner city urban experience, but also with very low income. In some ways, I have taken jobs that don't pay that much. So these are neighborhoods that are more reasonable. In some ways, I find it easier. And it's kind of where I've chosen to be. I was really raised on a kind of spirituality that was pushing the finding of God in marginalized communities, and I wanted to, you know, experience that. Okay, so when I was in China, I moved into a home with a woman. She was actually a single professor woman. It's very rare not to marry in China. She was handicapped. She couldn't walk. Just took me into her house. I met her through a friend. And it was a quite deep experience. She was extremely frugal. I mean, even among Chinese people, she was frugal. She would do things like scrape out the lining of an egg. Her name was Guan Ai. And, you know, she never wasted anything. We did arrange to have her come here for about 6 months, and she lived with me in Philadelphia. So one day, I take her to the library at Chelton and leave her by the copier because she can't really walk. And when I come back, she's got a ream of clean white paper. She's stuffing it into her bag, and she tells me, "Well, Dee Dee, somebody threw this paper away." And, you know, it's perfectly good unused copy paper, so I'm totally in her court. So she says, "I'm just going to make it into envelopes." And, of course, I didn't tell her, you know, at that point, I had millions of recycled, upcycled envelopes. So the next morning, she's folding all the paper, which I don't even know how to do, in these beautiful symmetrical envelopes. So I was like, okay, here's a glue stick. I leave her a glue stick. I go to work. I come back. She's got them all glued, and she has my glue stick there, which she hands back to me, and she says, "You know, Dee Dee, I don't need your glue stick." She said, "I had noodles stuck to the bottom of my pot at breakfast, and I was going to have to throw them away, so I just used those to glue the envelopes," which is not something that would even occur to me. And she had probably spent 6 hours of the day constructing this pile of, I don't know, 50 envelopes. So I just thought, what in the world will bring these two worlds together? You know, she comes here and the waste is so unfathomable. These are things that do not occur to people in the first world. It just seems crazy. Yet the rest of the world is living in this kind of scarcity. It is startling. When I lived at Guan Ai's, we took out the trash every week. It filled one dustpan. That was it. And so when you do that, you realize this is totally a constructed world of trash. We could deconstruct this world. We don't have to package things like this, ship things this far. And I think that's what's so frustrating, that it's almost things we've learned in the last 50 years, and we could unlearn them because we did them a different way 50 years ago. When you live among different kinds of people and you see how they deal with economics, scarcity, how they make do, what they feel they, quote, need and, quote, don't need. If you have those experiences, you can carry one worldview into the other place. So And you can use that as a lens to figure out where do you really want to stand? You know, what do you want to feel is essential? What are the benefits that you get from physical things?